Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks for joining me today. I just finished talking with Richard Jean So about his new book, Trans-Pacific Community, America, China, and the Rise and Fall of a Cultural Network. This came out in 2016 with Columbia University Press. Now, this is a book that is speaking simultaneously to a number of different fields, and I think really compellingly in each of the cases. It's a work of literature and the history of literature. It's a work of early 20th century history and history specifically of U.S.-China relations. It's also a work that's inspired in really interesting ways by threads from media studies and science studies to tell a story of the emergence of not just particular media and kinds of mediality for creating community across the Pacific, but also ways of thinking about and producing networks, literary networks, and cultural networks and other sorts of networks. So it's doing a lot of really interesting kinds of work that all articulate with each other. The book does this by taking a number of individuals. Each chapter takes one of these individuals and tracking that individual member of the group that Richard's describing over the course of the book, looking at their encounters with other American and Chinese writers, and looking also at their integration into a broader cultural network. And in each case, readers will find some figures that they might be very familiar with, perhaps Pearl Buck, perhaps you've heard of Lao Sha, and some that they might not be so familiar with. But in each of these cases, these figures are embedded or enmeshed really interestingly in not just cultural networks, trans-Pacific conversations and communities, but also particular media like telegraphy, like radio, particular forms of writing, the typewriter, airmail. So there's a lot of really interesting attentiveness to media and communication in the course of this story. So I will let you get to it. I'll leave it there, but I'll just suggest listen in particular for the moments where you'll hear us talk about how excited some of the archival sources that Richard found and worked with were. So there are moments of the conversation you'll hear a real joy about the experience of working with particular textual materials in the archives. And also, if you get to the very end, you'll hear us talking about the FBI and Mr. Xu, S-H-O-E. So stay tuned, and you'll get to that story before you are done. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoy, and let's get to it. I'm here to talk with Richard Jean So about his new book, Trans-Pacific Community. Welcome to the podcast, Richard. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. And thank you both for writing a book that's so fascinating and also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome, and I'm really looking forward.
Thank you for having me, Carla. Really looking forward to this.
So let's start big, Richard. Let's start with the traditional opening question. What brought you to the field? And specifically, how did you come to decide to work on modern literature, especially with at least one foot in Asian and Asian American studies?
So I guess it first depends on which field you're talking about. In terms of modern Chinese literature, I'm a true interloper, latecomer. My undergrad and early graduate school education was really focused on American literature, especially 20th century American literature. And that was always my primary passion and my interest and focus. And I became interested in Asian American studies in the early part of graduate school in the early 2000s. And at that time, that field was very not very particularly comparative or transnational. And the major rubrics were things like Orientalism or minority discourse. And so even as late as 2003, I had never taken a Chinese language class or a literature class. I couldn't read a character of Chinese. I came to this, the field of Chinese literature through this question that was troubling me. And the short version of this question was, I want to know more about the early formation of the concept of an Asian American person or subject, which would be something like the 1930s or 1940s. And I was doing some research on Pearl Buck, and Buck, as you know, had spent a lot of time in China, and there was an interesting conundrum around her role in some legislation that was important to the legal definition of the Asian American person in the early 1940s and her time in China. That was, to me, a lacuna in knowledge, because to fully reconstruct that history, you have to know something about China, about Chinese literature, Chinese culture. And so to kind of just resolve or answer a question in my mind that was really troubling me, I decided to learn Chinese. And I thought it would be much easier. I thought I could do it like in a year. It became something like 10 years, or it's still ongoing. Yeah. I'm happy to talk more about that. But I came to this field through a kind of research problem or question, and also a personal question too at the same time. And I began the process of getting into Chinese studies through that. And eventually over time, I put together my two interests through that project.
That's exactly how I came to the field too. So I completely am vibing with what you're saying.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's why I started working in Chinese too. It was just, I was interested in a question. So I am totally in support of that. And anybody listening right now who also has had that experience, you are in good company, and come join the team. So the book that we're talking about today, Trans-Pacific Community, proposes a new conceptual framework for understanding what the book calls the intellectual and cultural relations between East and West, China and America. It focuses on a group of American and Chinese writers in the decades after World War I. And this period winds up being really important and fascinating for all kinds of reasons. You're showing here a transformation in U.S.-China relations. There were transformations in the world economy and in international politics, amongst other kinds of changes. Now, one of the really interesting kinds of changes, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, in the hour to come, was the rise of a new era, as you put it here, in media technologies. And this included the formation of a massive technological infrastructure between the U.S. and East Asia. And in part, this was due to radio and telegraph technology and a trans-Pacific transportation system. You're also showing here a concomitant rise of a discourse of communication specifically. Okay, so this is just to lay a little bit of a groundwork for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book to kind of understand the foundation we're talking about. So, Richard, how did you come to this project? You've said a little bit about how you came to Pearl Buck specifically, and she's certainly one of the main figures in the book, but more broadly, what brought you to an interest in this particular problem and these particular characters as a way of understanding this problem?
Thank you for that summary to the project. That's a very pithy and good summary. Specifically this project, it began as a kind of almost a biography of a group of people. The project began with this interest in Pearl Buck. I was very interested in the early 20th century just because it seemed like I want to know more about, again, the emergence of Asian American culture, which tends to be located in the 1960s and 1970s. But the more I read into that period, it seemed that, again, there was a large lacuna in understanding the things that came before. It seemed that the genealogy for these things in the 1960s and 1970s, Asian American cultural nationalism, things like that, took place earlier, or the genealogy stretched back into the interwar period, the 1920s and 1930s. So, and it seemed like the main figure for this, thinking about this problem, was Pearl Buck. And through that, a whole window of this broader history, I saw the early outlines of this massive cultural exchange between specifically China and America in this period that I felt that we didn't really know enough about. And so I began with Buck, and then I spent a lot of time just looking at her social networks, her cultural networks, her coterie. And one by one, figures kind of came into view. Something I do in the book is I try to start each new chapter by showing like a very concrete link between between the previous chapter's main protagonist and the next chapter's protagonist, to give a sense of really the sense of coterie or connections between these figures. And so I think the order was Buck led me to Lin Yutang. Obviously, they're very close. And from Lin Yutang, I discovered Agnes Smedley. From Smedley, I discovered Lao She, and then from Lao She, I discovered Paul Robeson, and it became a really emerged as a very coherent, interconnected community, which itself is very interesting because these are very different people. I saw the research as kind of like unraveling this thread of connection between these figures, and these figures, in my mind, emerged as the most interesting and important for this period in terms of the bigger question of just understanding the basis for U.S.-China cultural interaction in the early 20th century.
Awesome. So, yeah. So, Richard, how did the project change from its instantiation as a dissertation to its transformation into a book? Were there any kind of major transformations, for example, in the way you were conceptualizing the problems, the way you were structuring it, or kind of any other notable part of the process you'd like to share?
Yeah, actually, I'd love to talk about this at length because there are major transformations. And here I should thank my colleagues at the U of Chicago English Department, because they really pushed me to really expand and enrich the project. Organically, how this happened. So I wanted to revise it, but more than just for the sake of revising it, the substantive intellectual development that happened was the dissertation was really just a study of political and literary exchange with these four figures. The Robeson chapter I had not yet figured out for the dissertation. So for these, basically two Chinese writers and two American writers, so Smedley and Buck and Lin Yutang and Lao She, for the dissertation. And I was tracing these patterns of, again, political and literary exchange. A lot of that made it into the book. But what I figured out once I graduated that this mode of interaction was really distinct from 19th century versions of U.S.-China interaction, the majority of which is really rooted in Orientalism, kind of like exotic or occidental forms of perception. And it's just intuitively, I want to figure out why that model changed in the early 20th century. And the more I thought about it, and also just a very intuitive explanation is that Chinese, it was easier to communicate and encounter people from China or America on the opposite shore, starting roughly after World War I. And then it became, I was doing a lot of reading and media and communications history. And then I did a lot of research into the Trans-Pacific, its version of media and communications history, and the missing piece. So if I would describe it as if the dissertation had kind of two legs of a table, say political and literary history, media history kind of provided the third leg, kind of made the other two parts make sense. And that, as you're describing in your really nice description of the project, the major revolution in the early 20th century for the Trans-Pacific was the creation or the availability of these new technologies that made a kind of interaction suddenly possible, that you could communicate very quickly with people very far away. And tropes of Orientalism start breaking down, because once you can, you know, interact with people very different from you, you start seeing them less as exotic oddities and more people you can talk to, share ideas with, and collaborate. And that, to me, was the missing explanatory component for why there was all this cultural exchange happening in the 1920s. It's because suddenly it was easier to talk to people really far away, as a kind of shorthand. So, yeah.
Let's actually, this is a great way to start getting right into it. So let's actually take this point about media and media and communications histories and use this as a way to start diving into the book. So a central claim of the book is that, and this is in the words of the book, literary histories of U.S.-China cultural encounter in the 20th century must also, in part, be histories of media. And this is true. I mean, we see this coming up throughout all of the chapters of the book. It's a really strong element of the kind of collective arguments that the chapters are making and also the contributions I think they're making to a number of different fields. So the book recasts the Pacific in the 20th century as what you call a site of mediation. And you develop a notion of what you call textual mediation as a way of developing this idea of the Pacific as a site of mediation. So as a way of starting to get into or further into the ideas of the book, Richard, can you talk about this notion of textual mediation and its significance for the work that you're doing with the book in terms of media studies?
Thanks. Actually, those two sentences are two of my favorite lines in the book.
So oh, I love that. Oh, great.
So thank you for that. This was a long process, as you know, as someone who's written a serious academic book, that it's you write the chapters, and then when you're trying to come up with the higher level concepts, it takes a long time for things to crystallize, for the book's introduction and the framing. I knew as I was writing the chapters that the Orientalism framework was limited for what I wanted to do, but more importantly for the materials I was working with and the stories I was discovering. And I should also say that I was really always drawn to Orientalism. I actually studied with Ever Said before he passed away in graduate school. So that was a very powerful framework for me. And it's only through discovering this this history that I realized that it demanded a different kind of methodology, a different conceptual framework. And it came together, I would say, I was looking for an account of literature in a transcultural context, not based on representation, and a keyword that is opposite to or supplemental to representation, of course, is mediation. If you're not representing something, you're kind of mediating two things with a text. And I would say the linchpin for helping me figure this out was really reading deeply into Bruno Latour's work, who, as you know, is very important for media studies and thinking about objects and how they mediate relations between humans and other objects and things like that. And I read some really great work in the history of science by there's a great book on the broker world, I think, by Simon Schaefer, Del Borgo, and some other people. So it was really from the history of science, people working out of the Latourian framework for thinking about, also Peter Gallus, and thinking about how scientific innovation happens through these trading zones of ideas and actors and objects, kind of enabling those connections between different ontologies and epistemologies and so forth. So that was really helpful for me to start thinking about books as objects in the world, physical things that help to mediate the relations between things that are very different. So say America and China or American-Chinese concepts. But I should say specifically the kind of on the ground trigger for this was discovering Lao Xie's handwritten manuscripts for Si Shi Tong Tang, Four Generations Under One House, where I talk about this in the book chapter, but where the page itself became the site by which Lao Xie and his translator really worked out ideas. And I really started seeing books and pages as physical things where that aren't just, like a representation of China, but the place really where writers can really work out ideas about China and become a much more complex account of China that's not just based on representation. I would say, it was readings into a certain tradition, a Latourian framework combined with some just archival documents I was finding that that kind of trigger this conceptual framework of textual mediation as something that would allow me to think outside of Orientalism as an interpretive apparatus.
Great. Now, as someone, I love that you just mentioned all this stuff, because as someone who spends a lot of time in STS or science studies, one of the things that was really striking to me as a reader was the way that you were invoking and using this idea of networks, right? And this definitely comes up, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about this at more length in this chapter five that you are kind of alluding to, where you talk about Lausche's work and the notion of a literary network, but specifically these archival materials from Harvard's Radcliffe Library, which were like these draft materials for the co-translation of this book you just mentioned, Sister Tong Tong, translated as The Yellow Storm. It's so fascinating. And I just want to flag this for listeners in case we don't have a chance to talk about this in detail when we get to chapter five, because this is like not just your kind of your what we might imagine to be a kind of normal process of translators working together to, or an author working with a translator to translate a text, right? This was an extraordinarily fraught process where he was working with Ida Pruitt to translate this text. And we really see that coming off the page that you give us, or the pages you give us. So yeah, that's a super awesome chapter. And we'll get to that in a little bit more detail. And also in terms of how it speaks to or might speak to the importance of networks here to the story. But before we get there, there's a first, a second, a third, and a fourth chapter. So let's try to get a little bit into those. So chapter one looks closely at the collaboration between Agnes Smedley and Chinese writer Ding Ling. Now, it looks at Smedley's efforts, among other things. And I should say, just as a kind of oral footnote, there's a lot going on in all of these chapters. And we're just going to kind of scratch the surface. But listeners who become readers will find a lot more detail in all of these chapters. But so one of the things that this does is looks at Smedley's efforts to publicize the nationalist imprisonment of Ding Ling in 1932 and to coordinate a partnership between the ACLU and the China League for Civil Rights in a kind of trans-Pacific political campaign. Now, you show here that this effort, on at least in part on the part of Smedley, to join America and China to a common conception of democracy, this is another theme that threads throughout the book, depended on new forms of communication and expression. And you talk a lot here about the significance of the telegraph, specifically in enabling this. So Richard, I'm going to keep this fairly open and just invite you to talk about that part of what's happening in the chapter. For you, what's most interesting about the way that the telegraph specifically as a medium is enabling the development of a common conception of democracy?
This also came as a surprise in the archive that I was led by the materials, and in that initially it began as a study of a group of American intellectuals associated with the American Civil Liberties Union, so Roger Baldwin, Agnes Smedley, basically hashing out ideas with Chinese intellectuals, so Song Qingling and Ding Ling on behalf of Ding Ling, trying to figure out how to make a case, a legally rigorous case for Ding Ling's civil rights, to possibly put pressure on the KMT to free her from prison, that her civil rights were being violated. So in the initial version of that chapter, this was a dissertation version, I just was looking at their correspondence, and I was interested in the kind of political theoretical arguments that they were trying to figure out. How could someone in China be eligible for a Western concept like Western democracy, Western civil rights? How do you extend that concept outside of the United States into, say, semi-colonial Shanghai? So that was really interesting to me. But I really started noticing that a lot of this was happening over telegraph. The thing that occurred to me was that the medium of the exchange of the ideas mattered. So this is how media theorists like Kittler and McLuhan are very important to me, that I just felt that I could not ignore the materiality, the medium by which they were communicating. And I found some interesting things, that the telegraph was very important, in that the speed by which it enabled the exchange of ideas was very important. And the form of the telegraph itself became a mechanism to make certain appeals, and that they used kind of like telegraphic language to make these claims or these arguments or just the condition of Ding Ling's imprisonment more vivid, such that the telegraph, as compared to, say, a novel or just a newspaper article, was somehow could be more powerful in conveying this political outrage and crisis to a broad number of people, because a lot of these telegraphs were circulating between large groups, like large factions of leftists in various countries, including Russia, which I never got into. I wasn't able to, but yeah. In short, the telegraph was a new medium that has certain advantages: a kind of pithy-like nature in the writing, but also a kind of speed and ability to be disseminated broadly that gave additional power to this transnational political campaign. So yeah.
You also make the point in this chapter, and I think this is really interesting, that this mode of communication or medium of communication helped a new form of writing to emerge as a result. And you call this long-distance realism. Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Yes. This work is very much indebted to some important work in Victorian studies. So I want to give a shout out to Richard Mencke's book, Telegraphic Realism, and also a book by Kate Hales. The title escapes me, but she's also written on the telegraph. But yeah, this idea of telegraphic realism, these people involved in this campaign were also writers, and a lot of them were realist authors. And I found evidence to make an argument that the telegraph was imbuing their sense of their use of literary realism and vice versa, a kind of synthesis, drawing on the strength of both. So realism, of course, has natural strengths, but the telegraph also has some special powers too, namely a kind of very vivid, brief kind of form of expression that's very modern. And I found that these writers discover that in some ways, writing their stories adopting some of the formal qualities of the telegraph can make some of their writing more powerful and more appealing, particularly in conveying things like social outrage or political crisis. And so, yeah, I find evidence that how some of these writers were writing, so say Ding Ling or Smedley, was influenced by the telegraph to write in a particularly strong political idiom. But also how these stories are sometimes translated were also influenced by a kind of telegraphic style. And all these just added up to a kind of what I would call a long-distance realism, which is a form of realism that is sort of mobilized by a telegraphic ethos to make it travel very far and wide like a telegraph.
Great. Now, the second chapter also charts the emergence or the creation of a kind of realism. This is a sort of hybrid form of realism, as you call it, by Pearl Buck in her work. So this is chapter 2, and it looks at the work of Pearl Buck and her relationship with Chinese culture and writers by focusing on her work, The Good Earth. Now, you show here that she's creating this hybrid form of realism that mix American realism and the classical Chinese novel, with the water margin being an especially important example of the classical Chinese novel that she's working with. And you talk a lot about her engagement with the water margin in this chapter. So she finds a kind of what you call latent democracy in the water margin. And this is all part of a larger point of this chapter, where you are showing us that through her novel, The Good Earth, she's developing and describing a kind of natural democracy. Okay, so since democracy, this has already sort of come up a little bit in our conversation, this is something that's a thread throughout the entire book. Can you talk a little bit about this idea of natural democracy? Why is it important for Perk? And for you, what's most interesting about the way she's developing that idea in terms of the larger arguments that this chapter in the book are making?
Yeah, thanks for that summary. So, I mean, the book really began, the Buck chapter is really the heart of the book. It's the first chapter I wrote for the dissertation. It's probably the most substantial in the book. And for the political argument, it's true that the book's interest in democracy emerging in a very transnational, Pacific-oriented way in this period, that's one of the central claims of the book. And you're precisely right that the book chapter does the most work in articulating this. And this discovery that I made, which was really the first discovery of all the research, starting with the dissertation, and what I found most compelling about this project is precisely that in the early 20th century, a lot of Chinese intellectuals were already rereading Shui Huizhuan as articulating a kind of latent democratic ethos that resonates with Western accounts of the democratic ideal in the 19-teens, 1920s. So someone like Liang Qichao has written extensively about this. Bok's really interesting intervention into this is that she wanted to push that argument even further to say that there's a commensurability between a Chinese discovery of a latent, democratic genealogy within Chinese culture, say something like Shui Huizhuan, and American ideas of democracy, particularly Jeffersonian democracy. And I find evidence in The Good Earth and other texts that she's precisely writing these books to articulate that commensurability, to imagine a very distinct international, global, Pacifically inflected idea of democracy that really harmonizes Chinese ideas of democracy from a kind of Ming Qing context with an American Jeffersonian idea of democracy. And to me, it's a very radical idea because it really provincializes an American idea of democracy through a kind of, routed through an early modern Chinese lens. So it's particularly that synthesis I find most interesting, that Bok was really intent on revealing that synthesis, that unification of Chinese and American notions of democracy, but particularly through an early modern or 17th, 18th century genealogy. So very, very surprising to me, very interesting.
Great. Now, the chapter is also doing a bunch of other kinds of work, and we won't have time in the context of this conversation to talk at length about it, but I just want to flag some of that for listeners. The chapter, in addition to doing all the kinds of work that you just described, is also tracking Bok's novel's reception in China and America as a way to understand the Pacific book trade. And this is a trade that was made possible going back to the significance of media, just briefly, as you say in the book, by new developments in airmail, which I think is really interesting. You talk here about the ways that the circulation of the book between the U.S. and China created feelings of what you call historical simultaneity between the two. So that's another really interesting part of what's going on here. And you also describe the way that Bok's work and its reception helped form what you call a U.S.-China cultural public and helped articulate a Chinese-American political subject. So this is just to say for listeners, there's a lot more going on in that chapter, and I hope they'll have a chance to read it because there's lots of great detail. But we need to get to Chapter 3 because Chapter 3 is my everything. Really, this chapter is my everything. I mean, all the chapters are great, but I love this chapter. So Chapter 3 is fascinating. This looks at the collaboration between Paul Robeson, and you've mentioned him briefly before. He was a very well-known, famous African-American musician and actor, and Liu Liangmo, a left-wing Chinese musician and writer. Okay, super fascinating. We could seriously talk for 2 hours about this, and we will one day. But for now, let's just kind of give listeners a sense of some of the interest of the chapter. Okay, so let's start with Robeson. In the 1930s, he develops an idea of, in the words of the book, an Afro-Chinese cultural convergence and affinity. Now, in part, this is built around his idea of what's called the human stem. All right. So, Richard, briefly, what's this idea of the human stem in the context of what's interesting for you about Robeson's work?
So the research on Robeson began with this human stem idea that he started developing in the 1930s. So Robeson, just as some background, was a truly interesting person, probably best known as a major African-American singer and political activist, but was a real intellectual. So he spent a couple of years at SOAS in London studying Asian languages. So was a kind of linguistic genius, knew many, many languages, including Russian, Hebrew, and Chinese. But he was particularly drawn to Chinese and China, Chinese culture. And he did a lot of research at SOAS, also at Columbia, starting in the 1930s. And he was obsessed with finding the basis for a connection between these two cultures. And he found it in this idea that at base, Chinese and African American cultures share a basis in the pentatonic, which is a kind of musical scale that's most common in folk songs, ballads, and things like that. So he developed this human stem concept to say that all cultures with a particular disposition that he called democratic flow from a common stem, which he names as the pentatonic scale, a kind of cultural basis. And he really believed that it's African American, or say African culture and Chinese culture, articulate the human stem at its kind of at its most foremost node point, and that it's really that they are kind of at the origins of the basis for this connection between all cultures, and they share a profound bond, a cultural bond in their shared basis in this pentatonic scale.
So Liu actually tracks him down, right? Finds him. They start working together, and together they develop a notion of pentatonic democracy. And you've just kind of talked a little bit about that, right? This based on the commonalities of the pentatonic scale, or like the black keys on a piano, is how I think the book describes it. I think that's a useful way of visualizing this. What is particular about the form of democracy? If there's anything that you'd want to add beyond what you've already said, which is, I think, fairly complete, but is there anything else you'd want to add about what particular form of democracy this pentatonic democracy is beyond what we've talked about?
Yeah, I would say that they were very, again, and a lot of Robison's thinking was not what I would describe as rigorous scholarship. And it's, but what I'm interested in is how he thought about this, because it became that it took on a social force, even if it had some dubious intellectual claims. I think the main thing that he was interested in was that the pentatonic, which is the black keys on the scale, is often the basis for folk culture, culture identified with rural cultures, again, kind of like African-American or rural Chinese cultures. And he really wanted to position that against the diatonic scale, which is the white keys, which he associated with, say, European classical music. And he creates a kind of binary to say that that kind of music and culture has kind of left the people. It's been sort of relocated in cities and elite locations. And he identified then that kind of music, which is based, again, more on the diatonic, as not democratic. So he really believed that the pentatonic, in terms of its relationship with the people, the folk, was a cultural basis for imagining a political democracy. So the pentatonic democratic idea is very important, in that it builds from the human stem idea, which is a purely a cultural claim, and then inflecting it with a democratic argument.
And this is really interesting for anyone who's spent any time reading W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, right? Because there's also a really interesting thread through that book of music and sound. And so there's lots of resonances to kind of choose a perhaps particularly apt figure for this. There's lots of resonances here for me that speak to some other stuff I'm interested in. But one of the really fascinating things about what's happening in this chapter related to that is the way that it's linking sound and the sonic to democracy, to politics, to the way all this is playing out. And sound and the sonic becomes super, super important to a lot of elements of the story of this chapter. So one of the things that particularly interested Robison about the Chinese language, as you showed here, was its sound, right? Its sonic aspects. You talk about the significance of the auditorium and the sonic aspects of the auditorium as a space for generating particular forms and experiences of sound in the way that these two people work together. But you also talk, and this is what I'd like to ask you to speak just briefly about, because selfishly, I just think it's really cool, and I get to ask you questions. So, so you talk about the medium of the voice, right? The recording and dissemination of the voice as being central to the work that Liu and Robison are doing together, and the kinds of proximity that they created, right? The kinds of likeness and proximity that they're creating. So, Richard, can you talk a little bit about that for you. What's most interesting here about what's happening around the voice as a medium and in general, the sonic and its importance to this chapter?
This went through a couple iterations. This chapter went through a bunch of revision. I should thank an anonymous book reviewer at Columbia University Press for helping me with this. But the voice, I began with just a study precisely of the voice or a representation of the voice, insofar as the argument I was interested in making is that the book really accelerates in this chapter because I move from a literary context to a purely sonic context. And the claim is that when we move out of what is often called a letter modernity, so books, printed books and novels and things like that, that the possibility for new juxtapositions and combinations of otherwise antithetically defined things like Black culture, Chinese culture, can somehow have more mingling and fusion once you leave that lettered modernity and move to a sonic context. There's just, it's less constrained by convention or say like 300 years of the printed press and its various norms. That's how it began. I was really interested in the kind of liberating force that the voice would have just sort of singing, that Robeson singing Chinese or Liu Liang Ma singing African-American gospel in Chinese, that this there wasn't a sense of violation that the voice itself could contain this juxtaposition in a very liberated way. So that was the first part of it. The second part of it, though, was the media question, which is despite that, there is a kind of shock or surprise to see a Black man singing in Chinese, which was the case in the early 1940s when Robeson performed these songs in concert. And that's unavoidable because that starkness, that surprise is I think just intuitively and historically was surprising. And this is where I got very interested in the history of sound technology, where the more I read into it, so Emily Thompson's work and David Sweetsman's work, that it was also a time when the voice was becoming severed from the body, that the voice itself could just circulate freely, not only in auditoriums, but just society through new recordings. And a lot of the work in African-American studies sees that as very damaging in that it allowed, say, white listeners to consume the Black voice without the kind of lingering, the looming threat of a kind of Black body. And that research is completely accurate and it's excellent, and I learned a lot from it. What I found, though, was for this particular juxtaposition, it kind of helped in that the Black voice in Chinese or Chinese in the Black voice, because it was circulating and it was sort of disembodied, it benefited from this open circulation in auditoriums and just, you know, streets, you know, via radio and things like that, that again kind of liberated, it made more possible liberatory expressions that otherwise might be policed, this kind of juxtaposition of Black and Chinese, if people were focusing too much on the visual spectacle of a Black man singing Chinese. So in my reading, it's really this new media environment that really liberated voices from their initial context, which, again, in one context, you know, Black culture can be very, very toxic and damaging, was in this context, in a way, empowered both Leo and Robeson to, again, experiment and see how far they could push this collaboration, this kind of voice.
Great, thank you. So as we move from here to the next chapter, we move to a chapter, chapter 4, that looks closely at the work of Lin Yutang. Now, in the 1930s, he fled to America, and particularly interesting in this chapter, and there's lots we could talk about here, but just for the moment, we'll talk about this, is the way that Lin made use of new technologies to extend what the novel could do. So you talk here about something that's actually been emerging as an interest and a concern in a number of different works lately, right? The interest in the typewriter and the typewriter in China, in particular, the typewriter in Japan. There are a number of really cool people working on this stuff, and that's a really interesting part of this chapter. But that's part of a larger argument that you're making here for the emergence of what you call typographic ethnic modernism on the part of Lin Yutang. So that's actually what I'd love to hear a little bit more about as we explore this chapter, Richard. Can you talk about this idea of typographic ethnic modernism and its connection with Lin's work, but also its connection with the larger, perhaps, goals of the book methodologically?
You're completely right that there's a lot of new interest in the Chinese typewriter. Here I should really give a shout out to a few scholars and friends of mine, Tom Mullaney, Jing Su, and John Williams, who have done really fascinating work on the Chinese typewriter, and listeners should all check out their work. I'm indebted to their research. The way that it entered my specific work on the new tongue is, I first came to thinking about the new tongue in the context of this literary and political context, where I was very interested in his collaboration with Pearl Buck and Richard Walsh, his publisher and his editor, in writing basically the first what was marketed in the public as the first Chinese American novel, called Chinatown Family, which was written in the late 1940s, and Lin was pressured by Walsh and Buck to start writing about Chinese people in America because of this domestic turn after the war in American culture. They wanted to basically sell books, and so I was struck by he was being forced to write in a particular way that I would call a kind of ethnographic style, which is common for Asian American writers based on expectations of publishers to say that what you should write about is yourself because, you know, there's this ethnographic impulse or mandate by publishers. And so we see that happening in the new tongue. And in the first version of this chapter, I find some really interesting ways that Lin is pushing back on Buck and Walsh to what they wanted was just a kind of traditional realist book about Chinese people living in Chinatown. But Lin was really an experimental, interesting writer, and he was very interested in modernism. And so I found some interesting ways he was deforming their expectations for what an Asian American novel should look like based on his sort of experiments with modernism. The way that the media stuff came in is precisely when I was revising this for the book after dissertation. I again found media studies, media history allowed me to kind of extend and ramp up the argument that I was already making if I looked at things like materiality or technology. And specifically, I found that it was his failed experiment in building a typewriter gave him his best ideas for creating a very interesting writing style for Chinatown Family that would defy the realist style that Walsh and Buck really wanted him to adopt. And the way I describe this is when Lin resorted to technology, it kind of interrupted or disrupted standard ways in which East and West would relate to each other, in that his writing became much more experimental. He was able to play with language. He was able to mix Chinese and English character words in really novel ways. So I would describe it as technology provides a leverage to do really interesting transnational things that kind of defy the mandates or expectations of nation-based cultures or ideologies. And so I put those things together for this typographic ethnic modernism to say that ethnic modernism is one thing, but when it's animated by a technological impulse or ethos, it becomes even more experimental and interesting.
Right. And so one of the things also related to this that the chapter is doing is showing the ways in which print technology was considered to be a way to democratize China and to develop an idea of what you call the Republican Chinaman here. So this is in the title of the chapter, and it's also a really important figure here in this context. Did you want to say anything more, Richard, about this particular notion of the Republican Chinaman as it's animated here?
It's kind of an elaborate argument. I'll try to explain this in a way that doesn't sound ridiculous. The main idea is that how it all came together is Lin Yutong in the 1930s back in China had a lot of interesting ideas about how to imagine a democratic Chinese subject. And the main thing is he believed that stemming back to writings by John Dewey and the Young Americans who he studied with and he knew well in New York when he studied at Columbia, that the key to at least a culturally democratic disposition for anyone is the ability to have free and open expression and communication. And he really wanted to, in his own writing, model an idea of a Republican Chinaman, a fully democratized Chinaman through a kind of liberal ethos, by producing a writing that was fully expressive. So his real conflict with Buck and Walsh was that they were trying to really constrain his ability to express himself when he was trying to do much more interesting, modernist, typographically experimental writing. And so not only creating the image or the representation of this figure in his writing, he also wanted to materialize a kind of practice for himself that would express a kind of democratic ethos for a Chinese writer that would amount to something that he called, again, a Republican Chinaman. So it's basically a cultural idea of democracy, that what makes someone democratic is this ability for free and open expression, particularly through creativity and writing.
Awesome. Thank you. So now we are coming to chapter 5. This is the last body chapter before the epilogue. And this is where we get the case that we were talking about before that's so interesting in terms of the archival materials that you were working with. This is a chapter that looks very closely at Lausche's visit to the U.S. from 1946 to 1950. And one of the first ideas that comes up here as a way of kind of motivating why the U.S. State Department might have been interested in inviting Lausche to the U.S., how that resonance might have worked, is the notion of propaganda or xuanquan. So can you talk a little bit to kind of start us off in our exploration of this chapter about Lausche's notion of propaganda? Or what, you know, we're translating here is propaganda, and the ways in which that's articulating with broader notions that facilitate this exchange.
So the research began with such a crazy historical incident or paradox, which is as late as 1946, the U.S. State Department invited Lausche, fairly well-known leftist at the time, to be a guest of the state. And I really want to understand how that possibly be, because obviously by 1950, Lausche is a hardcore Maoist and is writing these screeds against America. So those 4 years, in my mind, before I began the research, must have been super interesting, because how could that possibly happen? And to your question about propaganda, or rather xuanquan, and I do make the point that's not a great, in this context, not a great translation, because it's precisely that the State Department and Lausche had essentially, or they believe, essentially commensurable ideas of the social purpose of literature, which is to disseminate particular ideologies, which in one frame we could call propaganda. Here I call xuanquan because it's more of a harmony between aesthetic practice and political practice. I discovered a lot of interesting correspondence between Lausche and U.S. State Department officials in State Department archives, where they had a lot of really great correspondences where it was clear that they were on the same page in terms of understanding literature's relationship to the state, the state's relationship to literature, precisely through the idea that its purpose is to bear ideology and spread it broadly to across the face of the earth. And so I name this as xuanquan, Lausche obviously called it xuanquan, but I say that the State Department also had a very xuanquan idea of the function of literature that could also be called propaganda. But at the time, I think that idea was dissonant from how we think about propaganda today.
So Lausche is working with a group of American writers in this chapter based at the Yaddo Colony. And in particular, he's working with Agnes Smedley and Ida Pruitt. But Ida Pruitt, the relationship that he develops as co-translators with Ida Pruitt, as we've mentioned briefly earlier in this conversation, was really fascinating. So they worked together to translate his novel Si Shi Tong Tang into English. And the account of their process is actually fascinating. And the ways that you're kind of drawing some of that account from the archival materials we were talking about is also really fascinating. So for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the chapter, Richard, can you talk a little bit about what you take to be some of the most interesting aspects of their process of co-translation and the way that you are kind of drawing some of that out from these materials from the Radcliffe Library?
I would say the most important thing I learned about doing this research is it really put into question my ideas of authorship, in that that their collaboration was so intimate and so close, and this was part of the problem, because then who gets credit as the author? But they were really not just co-translating, but co-writing together. And the story is really transformed. So the English language version, The Yellow Storm of Cixi Tongtang, is quite different from the Chinese version. And I think you can really think of the English language version as itself a kind of autonomous novel. Another important thing, and I feel like this is a real challenge for Chinese literary history, that I find it amazing, truly amazing, that through this process, one of Lao Xue's well-known novels called The Drum Singers was originally written in English, which is amazing. And then later he translated it back into Chinese. And when I did research, no one really talks about that. But it basically, that novel was really written in this hothouse of co-translation where Lao Xue had a lot of ideas and he worked them out with Pruitt. But it was originally written to be published in English, and the original manuscript is an English language text. And so the fact that a canonical novel in Chinese was originally written in English is, just, again, mind-blowing to me. If, you know, someone said Mark Twain, you know, like Huck Finn was originally written in French, you know, that would be completely insane. So I think there's a lot of examples like this within these circuits of transnational collaboration that I think should, not only in the Chinese context, but just in literary history in general, that I think should put a lot of pressure on how we define national literatures and even what an author is.
Right. So Pruitt actually doesn't read Chinese, right? So, yeah. She's fluent in spoken Chinese. So am I getting this right that they would sit together and he would speak and she would write down or sort of translate the English version of what she heard him saying, right? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. So this was really fraught, as we were talking about before, because it seems that Pruitt wanted to kind of avoid Americanizing the work too much, which winds up producing a kind of Chinglish that he wasn't super happy with, right? Can you talk a little bit about those kind of competing interests among the co-editors or co-translators?
The main thing is Pruitt was an old-fashioned Orientalist in the good sense, in that she was a good scholar of China. She knew a lot about China, had excellent spoken language skills, and just really loved China in the, again, kind of the good old-fashioned idea of Orientalism. But obviously this is at odds with Lao Xue, who in some ways had some modernist ambitions and definitely had a modern notion of China. And so his ambitions was really to write things in Chinese and to translate them into English to count as very interesting modern literature. So a novel like Divorce, to me, is a very interestingly, you know, very stylistically and content-wise interesting novel. But the miscommunication is that Pruitt really thought that she was helping Lao Xue by making his stuff sound more kind of archaically like a Qing novel. And she thought that she was protecting his culture in that way, whereas Lao Xue obviously saw it as a kind of a bad version of Orientalism, that she was putting him into a box. And so that happens a lot. And that's an interesting genealogy for, American Orientalism, but also just the limits of multiculturalism in America. How much autonomy can you give to a minority writer to be him or herself? It prefigures a lot of Asian American writing that happens in the 70s and 80s, where publishers are putting profound pressure on Asian writers to sound more Chinese or whatever, and they think that they're helping them sell books, but it's actually just sort of exoticizing.
As we come to the conclusion of our conversation, we also come to the epilogue of the book. Now, in the epilogue, among other things, you're reflecting on the consequences of Lao Xue ultimately leaving the U.S. to go back to China. And you pose the question, or sort of repose the question, and use it to create a space to think with. The question is, what if he had chosen to stay in the U.S., right? What if Lao Xue had not left the U.S. to go back to China? So I think since this is the point at which the book concludes, this is a useful way for us to consider how to conclude as well. So Richard, can you talk a little bit about that question for you? In what ways is this question, what if Lao Xue had chosen to stay in the U.S., generative in terms of the goals that you have for the book?
It's really, to me, sets up thinking about the meaning of this history for the period that would follow, the PRC period in China, in the Cold War period in America, in that that counterfactual question of what happens if Lao She had actually accepted the U.S. State Department's offer of citizenship instead of going back to China to become a major cultural figure in the Maoist regime. I think if we trace out that counterfactual, we can start understanding the meaning of this history for the two things I'm interested in, the emergence of Asian American literature in the 60s and 70s, as well as the emergence of PRC literature also in that period. You could start, that counterfactual starts articulating some vital links, which is that we usually don't think of these things as completely antithetical. So the woman warrior has this long screed against communist China, and it's, you know, first pages. So we don't usually think of these things as connected. But through Lao She, we can start remembering that that these things can be connected or conceptually connected in terms of he was very close to staying. So if he had stayed, he would have probably become involved with, you know, he was such a cultural activist, he probably would have become involved with the emergence of Asian American literature in California in the 60s and 70s. He might have, you know, articulated connections to Maoist China. A lot of things that are muted in these histories that are very subtle. So like the subtle, some subtle liberalist ideas in PRC literature, or some muted, you know, very strong left-wing or even, you know, communist ideas in the emergence of Asian American literature. Things that are quite muted. If you really try to put Lao She counterfactually at their intersection, in my opinion, and the book tries to makes this wager that both PRC literature and Asian American literature just look somewhat different in relation to each other, but also autonomously. If you take seriously this interwar history as the basis for thinking about how those two things are still connected, even after the nominal disintegration of this community by 1915. So that to me is a real value, that counterfactual question.
So, Richard, we're now at the conclusion of our conversation, and there's so much more that we could talk about, right, in any of the chapters, not just in the Robeson chapter, but also in the others. But is there anything in particular that didn't come up in the course of the conversation that you would want to put on the table or mention for listeners?
I want to tell you about my favorite anecdote from – this comes up a little bit in the – it's almost like a joke, but – I mean, it's hilarious, but also super interesting. And I think it's a good example of the delights I found in doing the archival research. And so, I, Carla, I know you do extensive archival stuff. It's a real joy doing that work, because I always say the archive is always more interesting than the stuff you can imagine in your brain. Is this crazy? And so anyone, you know, on the cusp of doing archival research, you know, I think it's going to be a real joy for you. But so I was in the FBI archives. I had a set, because the FBI was spying on Smedley, and so it was one of the archives that I was looking into just to acquire, you know, more materials. And I found this one report that an FBI agent had filed, where he's basically describing like day 300 of spying on Agnes Smedley at the Yaddo Writers Colony. And then he kept on saying, he's like, in one of his notes, he writes that Smedley is spending a lot of time with this Chinese friend named Mr. Xu, MR.SHOE, literally Mr. Xu. And he keeps on talking about Mr. Xu, and like Mr. Xu is like some well-known leftist in China. We have to keep an eye on this Mr. Xu. I was like, who is this Mr. Xu? And I read more, and I finally put together that it's Lao She, that it was And I love this for a couple of reasons. One, I love this anecdote because I did not expect chapters 1 and 5 to kind of circle back on each other. So chapter 1 is Agnes Smedley, chapter 5 is Lao She. And it really confirmed my intuition that this group was really a group. And so that was nice. Another interesting thing I don't really get to talk about in the book, but this makes for good political history, it was the State Department that facilitated this, you know, this exchange and for Lao She to come. And it's like the FBI was at cross purposes. You know, they saw him as a threat, whereas the State Department had invited him as a guest of the state. So that was interesting. And I'm not really much of a State Department historian. So, but there's something to be made about that. That was interesting to me. Dissonances and weirdness of history, you know, that, I just love that, right? That was just really crazy to me. And I think that gets into like a footnote in chapter five. I tried really hard to put it in. But and you know, as you're revising a book, you have to make it very lean and very serious. So you can't, you have to cut out the kind of jokes. But I, yeah, that kind of was sad to me. I couldn't include that like in the introductory part of that chapter. But I love that. I love that.
So that crazy. Itself would make the basis for a fabulous humorous novel, wouldn't it? Just tracing this FBI agent, like a novel built entirely around the experience of this guy who's like Mr. Shu, like day 300 or whatever. Yes, somebody please write that novel and I will read it and interview you. So Richard, if you feel like getting into fiction writing, think about this. So, totally. So whether or not the next project is fiction writing, now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you currently working on now and what's currently inspiring you?
I'll try to be pithy. So anyone actually interested in this can like, you know, check out some of my writing or my webpage. I got really interested in understanding what happened like after this group disintegrated. So the short version of this is I'm working on basically a sequel that focuses on the Cold War period, again, studying U.S. East Asia relations, but primarily Taiwan and also South Korea, basically, you know, the post-colonial satellites of China and their relationship to America. And I'm interested in, you know, again, looking at a circle of figures, primarily a group of East Asian writers from post-colonial East Asian nations who came to study creative writing in America as a kind of key protagonist for the story about, again, the evolving nature of U.S. East Asia cultural relations. And I'm basically interested in how the institution becomes a central mode of that relation, whereas in the interwar period, as we're talking about, it's more of these sort of free-flowing social networks. And I find really interesting that all that goes away and it's all replaced by the institution, whether it's the University of Iowa, the State Department. And but I'm also interested in the continuities. I think, you know, we often think of 1950 as this radical rupture in history, but we can already start seeing in my chapter five, the seeds of the importance of the institution as brokering those relations. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested both in the discontinuity and continuities with the transnational interwar period, with the sort of institutional Cold War period. And also just, you know, the main keywords are thinking about from a history, you know, this idea of communications, which ties into history of science, that remains an interest of the mind, but also what does it mean to be creative? What is writing and how this all ties into the U.S.'s evolving attempt to develop relations with places like Taiwan and South Korea after the war. So that's basically, the short version of what I'm up to. And it's a sequel, more or less. Yeah.
Well, best of luck with that work, Richard. And I hope you do make time in the context of that work to take a break and write this novel about the FBI agent and Mr. Shu. And I'll check back with you on that. But thank you so much. Congratulations on the book. And it's really been a pleasure to talk with you about it.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much for reading so carefully in this conversation. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.